You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today to discuss our July 2026 Patron's Choice book club pick, Sunshine Nails by Mai Nguyen. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon supporter, you gain access to our members-only Discord server, where you can chat with us and fellow book club members about all sorts of topics, including our monthly book club picks. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a book club pick every quarter. And again, the book we're discussing today was chosen for us by our patrons. So as always, thanks to everyone who has become a member of our Patreon, and we hope to see more of you there in the future. So yeah, Rira, how's your summer going?
It's really hot. I did not move to LA for the humidity, so I don't know what's happening, but yeah. I am traveling to the East Coast in a couple days, and then after I come back from my trip from the East Coast, I'm going to Dallas, so I'm going to two hotter places,
yeah,
back to back, and I'm just like, couldn't LA have been a bit nicer leading up to my trips?
You know, so as someone who has lived most of my life in LA, for the most part, our summers are pretty, like, you know, everyone always says, oh, at least it's a dry heat. And that usually is the case, except for the last few years. Like, the humidity has noticeably ticked up the last few years, probably because of climate change, but also because this year there's a huge El Nino, which means we'll probably have a pretty, like, mm-hmm. heavy rainy season come fall.
I guess so. really do not like the freaking humidity.
Yeah.
It's definitely not as bad as what I grew up with in Georgia, because in Georgia, the air is just soup. So it's not that, but it's to a point where, like, you go outside and you can feel, like, the stickiness. And I was like, ugh, give me, like, 90-degree weather with dry heat yeah. any day than, like, whatever this is.
I think we're at maybe like 70-80% humidity. Granted, if you're in the mid-Atlantic, that's 100% usually. That's 100%, so it's like way muggier. But like when you're used to like 0 to 20%, this is pretty oppressive.
You know, like people would say like, oh, you're like Americans, like your heat waves aren't so bad. But then the Europeans came for the World Cup. And I'm like, were we exaggerating? Huh? Huh? Like, look at you guys drinking so much water when you guys were making fun of us for carrying our ginormous water bottles with us everywhere.
Yeah, it's definitely something you can't fathom until you experience. And, you know, that's why you should travel. Experience how people around the world feel about things. And then we all become closer. But yeah, I think we hit like the legal limit of weather talk for this podcast. So let us get into it. Before we get started on discussing Sunshine Nails, just a quick standard spoiler warning. During our book club discussions, we do discuss the entirety of our book club picks, including all plot and character related spoilers. And so, you know, it's a family comedy. So, you know, not a lot to spoil. But if you do care about like keeping the twists under wrap before you read it, this is your cue to hit pause on this podcast, finish the book, and then come back and listen to our discussion. But with that said, let's get into it. Rira, can you start us off, as always, with the book jacket description for Sunshine Nails by Mai Nguyen?
Vietnamese refugees Debbie and Phil Tran have built a comfortable life for themselves in Toronto with their family nail salon. But when an ultra-glam chain salon opens across the street, their world is rocked. Complicating matters further, their landlord has jacked up the rent, and it seems only a matter of time before they lose their business. They enlist the help of their daughter, Jessica, who has just returned home after a messy breakup and a messier firing. Together with their son, Dustin, and niece, Tui, they devise some good old-fashioned sabotage. Relationships are put to the test as the line between right and wrong gets blurred. Debbie and Phil must choose. Do they keep their family intact or fight for their salon? So this book takes place in 2016 in Toronto. And I was just looking through our Discord last night, and people were just like, ah, jump scare. Like, 2016 is now a period piece. And I agree. I had that same sentiment.
I mean, if you think about 2016, the year that we started this podcast, then we had such high hopes for the future when we because, again, for people who don't know the lore of Books and Boba, our first episode was literally like a month before the 2016 elections, when we had a more optimistic view of the trajectory of our futures. And you really do get the feeling of like the dread of like the oncoming, what's coming throughout this book, even though they're not specifically stated. Like those of us with cursed with knowledge now in 2026 know what's right around the corner for everyone. Even though the story is set in Toronto, like they're, you know, the whole world was about to change, right? You know, this was the year of Brexit. This was the year of like just a lot of like conservative right-wing powers like taking power.
Yeah, it's like even though they're in Canada, they can feel the temperature just dropping in terms of like, oh, our rights are in danger. And if our neighbors are feeling it, it's soon to cross the border somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what an interesting time period to put this in. I actually don't know when Sunshine Nails got published. Let me...
I think it was 2020, I want to say.
Okay, 2023.
2023, yeah. So yeah, it was published post-pandemic too. And that's another thing that's oncoming. Like, you know, we don't see, like, not to skip ahead, but like the future of Jessica's venture is also...
Oh no, I didn't even think about that. Oh my God.
Right?
Oh, man, that's terrible. Also, like the timing of this is timing of the story is also in 2016. The New York Times published an expose on nail salons and their exploitation of workers, mostly immigrants who, you know, some who were undocumented, some were who were held hostage to low wages and really dangerous environments. This in the story, like that article came out like a month before. So really like a hard time for the Tran family. And now they have an ultra glam nail salon that opens across the street. And I don't know if this was intentional or not, but there was like this really big chain American nail salon that was doing really, really well. And it like described like the design and decor to a T. I feel like it's marketing. I'm not going to name it because like whatever, they're out of business now. But like their business was kind of like, oh, all of our manicurists are like not Vietnamese, not Asian. They're like all white people who are quote unquote properly trained or like paid well.
Yeah,
it was like, yeah, it
kind of a dog whistle type of situation, right?
Yeah.
Like, fun story, it's also I learned this recently, like, you know, kind of like, you know, like back in during the Exclusion Act, right, you have like people advertising their laundry as French laundry, right? Because because these are as opposed to like Chinese laundry. Right. And when I learned that, I was like, because I've always wanted to go to the French Laundry in the Thomas Keller restaurant, but it was like, really, really put a damper on that plan.
Oh, that's surprising that you didn't know that. Yeah. I always thought it was like a weird name for a restaurant to take, because I'm like, the history is like so ick. I do like how the book briefly goes into like why there are so many Vietnamese owned nail salons. For those who don't know, like the industry began in like the 1970s when actress Tippi Hedren like came to a camp in California. And the refugees there, they were like, oh, we really like your nails. And then she was like, okay, I'll teach you how to like have manicures and stuff. So it was like a way for Vietnamese refugees to like get work training and also like have easier access to like business ownership. And that's why there's so many Vietnamese owned salons.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very common story, especially during that time with all the refugees coming in, right? It's a very similar story to the Cambodian donut shops and, you know, Chinese restaurants and even Vietnamese like restaurants, right?
Liquor stores.
Yeah. Right. Because when you come in, like, even if you're skilled, even if you have like degrees and stuff, like none of it, like without licenses, you can't do anything in the States, like legally. And to survive, to make money to support not only your family, but also your family overseas that weren't able to come over, you have to work essentially service jobs, right? Those are the only ones available. It's kind of, you know, it goes back to like the refrain that like, oh, immigrants are taking our jobs. But in reality, immigrants are doing the jobs that you don't want to do, but you rely on every day, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was interesting that, you know, like in the book, like this expose comes out and the Tran family and some of the Vietnamese community members are like, oh, this expose put a bad light on Vietnamese people. Like, we're not one of those stores who like store undocumented immigrants and like take their passports and pay them like non-living wages. And I'm like, okay, but just because you're not one of quote unquote those salons doesn't mean that it's like not a problem that doesn't exist.
Well, also Phil's saying that while he's undercutting his own workers,
yeah,
because they're family.
Oh my God.
Right? It's like, oh, it's okay if they're family, but we're not doing anything bad to like other workers. And it's like, it's very, so okay, this book is, you know, it's one of those Asian American family dramedies, or I think it's more comedy than drama.
It's more comedy.
Yeah. That we're following, you know, every member of the family with their own point of view story. So similar to The Wangs vs. World that we read last year, and other stories like, you know, Number One Chinese Restaurant. And I don't know if there's a specific term for this type of family drama, but like we're approaching the story through like multiple point of views, I think five total in this book. And so it covers a lot of different themes, right? You have the perspectives of the children who are like, you know, children of immigrants trying, one, you know, Jessica is trying to find success in spite of family, outside of the family. And you have Dustin, who's just trying to like do like the good immigrant son thing, which is like, just put your head down, do a good job. Eventually you'll get rewarded. And both of them kind of find that like following these two paths have led to really nothing for them, right? There's nothing at the end of the road except being exploited. And then you have the two parents who are, you know, first-generation immigrants who have first-generation immigrant anxieties, traumas, but also mentalities, right? They think their children are weak because they're not as strong as them. And, you know, all four of the main family members just make terrible decisions. Like, just constantly. Like, this whole story is just them making bad decisions, which is fun for us to read, but it's like not great for their situation. And you have Thuy, the cousin, who's kind of there as, like, she's more of an outside observer, right? And like a fresh objective look at like what the family is doing, like the messiness of the family.
Yeah, it's funny how like Debbie and Phil are like, oh, our children are not as resilient as us. And I'm like, okay, but there's Thuy right here. And she's been living in Vietnam like all these years. Like the Vietnam that you guys left, it's not the same. But also like it sounded like Thuy's family were living in very like dire conditions. And when Phil says like, oh, we need to like cut your pay because like we need to like, you know, make sure the salon survives, it's like, okay, but she's literally your family, and your definition of family is like shifting, so that's not great. And also like Thuy is just like, okay, well, she's stronger than you because she's going through more adversary as a young person who had just like freshly immigrated to Canada. So it was like nice to see like a contrast between like first gen immigration to like, oh, like a more recent,
yeah,
immigrant
different ways
who is younger.
Yeah. I will say it was kind of interesting. So I was born in Toronto, but I didn't grow up there, but I do have family there, so I visit a lot. And so it was kind of cool. Like, it's always cool just to see like, I think Mai did a really good job like setting the story in Toronto, right? With specific names and neighborhoods, because I definitely recognize like a lot of like the names. Like whenever they're driving down the road in the book. They do a lot of driving down the roads. So I recognize the streets that they're driving through, which was, I think she does a really good job setting the place, which I feel like it's, you know, it's not always the most important thing for, especially for like a more like kind of lighter comedy like this, but like, I think having like a very strong sense of place, especially if you're from there, like I think there's a personal pet peeve of mine, because I'm still holding on to the it's not really trauma, but like the grief of like the brother's son being a Netflix show set in the SJV that did not really represent or depict the SJV accurately. So when I see like someone like I'm putting effort to like create a sense of place that like people from there can recognize, I always appreciate that.
Yeah, like I don't know what the Junction, which is the neighborhood that Sunshine Nails is set in, as well as like Take 10, the ultra glam nail salon. Like it this is in 2016, and you can see signs of like gentrification kind of like inching in, right? Like there's a heritage building that that's, you know, being planned to get torn down for like an office that Dustin works for, which yeah,
the billionaire
we'll get
CEO
into.
Pushed through without like public inquiry, and like that becomes a big plot point as well. I do like that the book tackles a lot of themes, right? You have the gentrification, which is kind of the central theme of like development coming in and displacing older legacy businesses. It's something that we see happening everywhere, right? It reminds me of what's happening right now in like downtown LA. Like everyone's getting ready for the Olympics, they're building in new transit, but that's also driving up rents and pushing out like a lot of stores that like we grew up going to in Little Tokyo, and like Chinatown's already been gentrified, right?
Yeah.
There's that, but also like it's never explicitly stated, but I feel like a lot of this book is also a like, as with a lot of Asian American immigrant stories, patriarchy is also a big theme that this book tackles, because this was a topic that we discussed in the Discord, which is a bulk of the problems from this book stems from Phil, the father, making just terrible decisions and the women having to clean up after him and just making it worse, right? But it all stems from Phil deciding to go to a loan shark. Or no, it starts with him going gambling, and then he goes to the loan shark, right?
Yes, he goes to the casino to win the money for rent. And I'm just like, I don't understand anyone who's like, oh, I need to like make money real fast. I'm going to do the most dangerous and most like improbable thing of getting money. You're more likely to lose money than like win money. So I'm like, what? But like, that's like a gambler's perspective, yeah. Right? Like that's an addict's perspective. And in my notes here, I called Phil the problem. I also have a note saying the trans family inability to communicate and therefore making financial problems worse. And it's like, yeah, if everyone just freaking talked to each other and was honest from the beginning, then none of this would have happened. And it was so frustrating. Like throughout reading the book, like past like the halfway mark where like all of the money problems and schemes and blackmailing was happening, I was just like, no, screamed, like just like was so frustrated. I like yelled Jessica when she decided to like go ahead with, she's like, oh yeah, I'm going to accept the green card marriage in exchange for cash. And I was so relieved that didn't work out. But I was just like, girl, this is not the solution. Also, the problem is not like you don't have enough money to run the salon. It's that you guys are on like borrowed time. Your rent went up 50%. You have like fierce competition across the street. You guys are already a dead business. It's time to close up. And they're just like holding on to this hope, right? And it's like, I understand, but also you need to know when to call it quits, especially when you are gambling, going to a loan shark, blackmailing someone to like take their diamond ring and to like pawn it off. It's just like all of these solutions are bad.
Well, they're also in a bad place because Phil got a DUI, which shot up his car insurance.
Also
premium,
that, right? I'm like, why don't you just remove him from the car insurance?
And you know, that goes back to like the patriarchy thing, which is like, yeah, the women of this family bend over backwards to like coddle their men, right? Like something that I really keyed in on is like, you know, Debbie and Jessica, well, Debbie's always covering for Phil. Like she is covering up his indiscretions, trying to fix his problems. And, you know, Jessica wanting to fix her problems leads. But at the same time, like Dustin, the son, like his story is interesting because it's like the most removed out of the family drama, right? The family, he's not actively involved in any of the salon stuff. He's kind of doing his own thing, right? Which in itself, I think is also commentary on like he as like, I don't know if it's because he's the boy or because he's like just.
Oh, it's definitely because he's the boy. Are you kidding me? Like, especially since like, you know, the Tran family, they have these weekly gatherings at their house, right? Like where the men can gamble and they do karaoke. It's just like a way for the community to get together. And there's this chapter where Jessica is kind of like, she's getting like war flashbacks. She's like, oh yeah, like my mom would make me wear clothes that I don't want to wear. Like she would always criticize my appearance because, you know, she's like, your appearance reflects on my parenting abilities. And just like Jessica's accomplishments in life, like her becoming a casting director's assistant, like her looking so beautiful and glamorous, like none of that is a tribute to her. It's like, oh, you're like this because, you know, your mom raised you to be like this. So she kind of becomes like a trophy in a way. And also it's expected of her to like, you know, take care of, like, it's expected of her to work at the salon once she like moves back home. And I'm like, if this was Dustin, if he had come back home after like getting fired, he wouldn't be forced to work at the salon. Are you kidding me? So it's definitely like Dustin is a boy and he's allowed to do whatever he wants and be removed from dealing with the family's problems because, you know, it's like,
yeah,
they're just like, oh, you don't have to worry about it. You're like our golden boy, right? Like you work for Mootster, a tech company. You don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, so you get where I'm coming from. So it's definitely like, it's interesting to have his story there kind of just on the side. Like it was interesting. I was rooting for him to finally get out of that toxic relationship. But like in terms of like the family drama and the family like business, he was inconsequential at best, right? Like he didn't even like, did he even do anything yet? He helped with the party at the end, I guess.
Yeah. Like, so I was wondering about that too. What I was like, okay, like I understand that this book has like multiple POVs and is going through each family member's POV. And I was like, well, Dustin is kind of like, you know, his story is just kind of like, whatever, like what does this have to do with anything? But then we get to the chapter when Phil says, okay, I have to cut everyone's pay. And I was like, okay, here we go. So Dustin and Tui's arcs are parallel because they're both working underpaid jobs that they worked so hard. They poured so much time and effort into. And Mootster, this tech company, like they were a startup and Dustin was there from the beginning. And it gave the vibe of like, we're family, right? You're OG. Like you will be rewarded. Right. And he isn't. He's been unable to get a 10% raise since he started working there, and it's always been like, oh, there's other things. And this just like goes, it's like a commentary on like, you know, quote unquote Asian worker bees who like never get promoted and they're taken for granted, but like you need their hard work ethic in order for the company to survive. And that's what Tui is going through because she's the best nail technician in Sunshine Nails, and she's the one who brings the most customers.
Right. And they're both trapped in this like loyalty trap, right? Like they don't want to seem ungrateful, but also like there's a limit to how much they can take. Dustin definitely it's, you know, I keep wanting to say American Dream, but again, this is not set in America, but like, you know, the immigrant dream.
North American dream.
Like the diaspora, like children of immigrants, like the dreams of your parents, right? Like he symbolizes that, right? Like the kid who did everything right, who got the, you know, the prestigious job at a startup, and like, yeah, he's made it. But then you realize by reading his situation, he has not made it because his work, even though it is valuable, is not valued, right? And I think the turning point came when he realized that his coworker who started after him got a raise and is making more than him. Way more than him.
It was revealed that he was getting paid $5,000 more. And yeah. I was like, wow, I would rage quit too. What did you think about his email to his boss? Because I didn't really understand like his bionic code email, like resignation that he sent. And I was like, does it say like fuck you in code? I don't know.
I did not look up the binary translation. Yeah, but I'm sure it was something. I'm sure it was something very clever that the boss did not understand, because as with all tech CEOs, I don't think he like understands code at all, right?
Yeah. And I love how, you know, like Dustin, he meets Mackenzie, who is like a fellow worker there, and they're both like disillusioned by working for this company. They're like, it's toxic. And also like, is it really making a difference in people's lives? I mean, it's reading people's like heartbeats and emotions. Like, really, it's just not that necessary to like to human life. So they just like think, okay, like, what am I doing here? And I think that is like a very relatable, like 20s work experience where you're just like, yeah, I have the job, but what is this job actually doing for me? Which is nothing. And then Phil brings up like, oh, you're working on Sundays? Like, I didn't work so hard at a nail salon for you to work a job that takes away your weekends.
Yeah, it reminds me of like, you know, the parents who are like, I didn't work so hard at a restaurant for you to start a restaurant. But again, perfectly fine with Jessica working weekends at the salon.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was really, I mean, funny, but also really sad how she got fired from her job. She, like during a casting, during an audition with a big Hollywood star, she was supposed to read back lines. And one of the things that she had to do in the scene was to throw an apple. But then she threw it a little too hard and it hit the actor's face. And now no one wants to work with her anymore. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds like Hollywood to me. You make one one mistake with one big name and your career is over.
I mean, but she was also crashing out because she found out her fiance cheated on her too, right?
Yeah, and also she was high on weed. So technically, I mean, I can't feel too bad for her because it's like, why are you showing up to work high? But also it's Hollywood and I'm like, I'm kind of used to that kind of behavior too. So I'm like, I don't know. I guess.
But then we meet the rest of the family and it all makes sense. Like they're all really bad at handling emotions and impulses, right?
Yeah. I mean, Jessica and Dustin, I mean, their pastime is just smoking weed like constantly. It seems like that's like all they do on their free time. And you know, it made me wonder, I'm like, okay, is this like borderline substance abuse? But it seems like they get their act together by the end of the book. But we should talk about Savannah, the villain.
Yeah.
Is she the villain? I don't know.
The villain is themselves, let's be honest. Like the villain is the
trend. They are the problem.
Yeah. But Savannah doesn't help. And you know, something that we discussed on Discord was like one of our members mentioned that would all of their problems have been solved if Sunshine Nails just like increased their rates to make more money. But the thing is, like, what Take 10 represents is not a better nail salon, right? Because their rates, they're like charging $60 for a manicure, right? They're charging a lot of money. It's a higher price point. And the thing with the higher price point is it signifies that you're targeting a higher price point clientele, right? Because if you raise your prices from, you know, your no frills to that level, that means you're pricing out your regulars. And if they did that, they wouldn't have been able to attract the Take 10 clientele unless they make improvements to their store, right? Put an AC, update their equipment, their upholstery, their decorations. And at that point, all of those improvements would also put them in a bad space financially. Like the ultimate villain is not really Take 10. Take 10 is like the physical representation of gentrification, But that gentrification is the villain, right? Because that gentrification, what Take 10 does is it brings in like the higher earning clients. And because those people are now coming into Take 10, the surrounding neighborhood wants to also capitalize on that. And so the landlords see the opportunities like, oh, if I kick out my current tenants, I can bring in like a Chipotle, a Starbucks, like a Toulouse or like a Paris Baguette, right? That will service the new clientele coming into the neighborhood. And so that's the reason why older legacy businesses get priced out, because landlords see opportunity to bring in higher paying clients.
Yeah. And it makes you wonder, was Take 10 really taking clients away from Sunshine Nails? Like maybe like a few, but not like the bulk of their clients, because they're totally different.
Yeah.
Like people are going to Sunshine Nails because of affordable rates.
So yeah, so the real villain would be their landlord, who's like doubling their rates essentially.
Yeah. Like the second when they said, oh yeah, your rent is like doubled by January, I'm like, nope, that's when you look for a cheaper space. I mean, it's Toronto and that was like a theme, right? It's like, oh, everywhere is expensive, to a point where Dustin lives with his parents because it is just so expensive to get a place of your own anywhere.
Yeah.
And it's probably worse now. The gentrification at the Junction must have been completed by now. I don't know what it looks like now in 2026, but I'm guessing that those businesses that were slowly encroaching on like the old mom and pop shops, they're probably up and running.
Yeah. It's probably like a Din Tai Fung there now or something.
In Toronto? I don't know. They're
actually, no. Okay. So this is Toronto. This is Toronto gossip right now. But so for the longest time, there was a restaurant in Toronto called Din Tai Fung, which was, I think it was started by a former chef from Taiwan who opened up there. But they're not the real Din Tai Fung, but because they opened first in Canada, they held the naming rights in Canada. So for the longest time, Din Tai Fung proper could not expand into Canada, into Toronto, because this like this dupe version was there. And only recently did they change their name, because I guess they finally settled or they finally sold the rights. And so Din Tai Fung proper is finally coming into Toronto in the next like few years, probably.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Huh.
But yeah, so that's to say there probably could be 18 Tempo coming to the Junction sometime soon.
Yeah, I just want to go back to Savannah, the CEO of Take 10. I kind of found her to be like a caricature of like all the racist white ladies that can possibly exist, because she constantly mistakes Debbie for like one of the cleaning ladies. She like doesn't bother to like remember their names or faces, despite the number of times they like, you know, show up at her doorstep. And there's this conversation that Savannah has with Jessica at a bar. And this is before they know, like before Savannah knows that Jessica works at Sunshine Nails. And Savannah says, oh yeah, it's finally, quote unquote, their turn to take the market. And it was just like the biggest ick for me, because I'm like, okay, well, this was a business that no one wanted to do. So the immigrants took up that job. But now you see an opportunity because of this expose to just like monetize the distrust against immigrants. And I was like, oh, it's so ick. I hate it. And also on top of that, she's like so clueless and insensitive to like Asian culture. Like when she was talking about how it's like, oh, yeah, like I love kimchi, even though it looked like a wad of wet paper towels. And, you know, I had to like hold my breath when I like tried it for the first time. But now I love it because it's great for my skin. And I'm like, oh, God, like the commodification of Asian food because of its benefits. It's just like, I could go on and on about like Savannah's like racism and entitlement, but it really felt like she was a caricature, because no way.
Yeah, I feel like Maya had a really fun time writing her. Like she just like every single thing out of her mouth, whenever she was talking to one of the trans, was just like just white people ignorance. And it was very similar to like the way that Dustin's boss is too, which is like they're saying a lot of like things that sound good, but if you really listen, it's like horrifying or like not great or just nothing at all, right? A whole lot of nothing. And the whole Take 10, like they're providing a service, true, but at the same time, like the core marketing message is kind of it is very like come to us because it's cleaner, because it's not one of those nail salons, right?
Yeah. And also like, okay, there's that, right? But also they're being such mean girls. Like they literally sent two of their manicurists who were definition of mean girls over to Sunshine Nails and be like, hey, we're doing like mimosa and manicures. You guys are welcome to try our services, as if, you know, the people that they are pitching this to aren't manicurists themselves who like probably have more experience than them. And also like they were stealing business ideas, like promotion ideas. And I'm like, did you really have to do that? Like you already have like a large clientele and it's not the same as Sunshine Nail. So why are you using their promotion tactics with bring a friend and you get a discount?
Like, yeah, they're definitely like their pettiness triggered Debbie's pettiness too. Right? Again, like the core, like Debbie probably would have done something impulsive anyways, but this didn't help. Like this direct provocation did not help, right?
Yeah. Again, none of this would have happened if they just kind of saw the writing on the wall. And, you know, like Phil did like a whole Excel sheet being like, okay, like this is how we can continue to survive, but not for very long, right? So I'm like, I mean, you guys already know that it's impossible. So instead of like mitigating damages, you guys are creating more damages. And it was just like,
can't really look at this from like a practical point of view, because none of this is practical. This is all emotional. Like, this is something that they built through blood, sweat, and tears for years and years and years. So it's really hard to let go. And they did really try everything they could to survive. But again, it's like, it was ultimately futile because the winds of, like, you can't win against capitalism. Because the deck was stacked against them from the start. And, you know, part of, like, the immigrant, especially the refugee immigrant experience, is resilience against adversity. And this book, I did appreciate that, you know, this book could have went down the path of, like, oh, the business surviving, triumphing over adversity, taking down Take 10, saving the neighborhood. But it didn't go down that path, right? Ultimately, they do come to the decision that it's time to shut down. And, you know, it is sad. And, you know, Jessica was really upset about the closing. I think she took the hardest because, you know, she thinks she found something that she wants to be a part of. Like, she wants to be a part of the family business. But at the same time, it's also like realizing that the business, like the snail salon, was never like, this is not Phil or Debbie's American dream or Canadian immigrant dream, right? It's part of their story. It's like what they did to survive and to make money, but like it was never their dream to like own their own nail salon. It's not their dream to like spend every day and weekends working in other people's, you know, hands and feet and ruining their own skin in the process, right? And I think for us, the children of immigrants, especially children of like working class immigrants, it's sometimes hard to separate the parent from the work, right? Because it's, you know, a lot of times they're so entwined. But like Phil and Debbie, they're scrappy. They'll find something else to do. They'll find something other, you know, some other way to make money, to make a living, to get by. It's just the salon has run its course at the end. And I did like that it ends on like a hopeful note, right? Even though we know what's coming in 2016 and 2020, like it ends on like they're celebrating the salons and the relationships that they made instead of mourning that like they lost against capitalism.
Yeah. I don't know, like with Debbie, like I felt so bad for her, not just because, you know, she's married to Phil and like she believes that like their marriage has lasted this long because she's been like covering his ass and, you know, being like supportive and like forgiving of all of his mistakes and transgressions. But also like, you know, she seems to have a very strong like moral code, right? That's what she kind of like raised her children like on is like, what's right is right, what's wrong is wrong, don't steal. And what does she do? She blackmails Savannah into giving up her engagement ring because, you know, she catches Savannah cheating on her husband. And she's like, well, I need this money to pay back the loan shark because none of my jewelry is able to, you know, to be pawned for a good price. And it's not like she's, and she kind of like tries to justify it by saying like, well, she's not, Savannah is not, like, she's betrayed the sanctity of like marriage, or I guess like fiance, whatever. And it's just like, okay, well, she doesn't deserve that ring, but that's not morally right either. And this is like a big moment for Jessica when she finds out that like her mom did this, right? And she's like, okay, like this whole money situation is making my parents into people that I don't recognize. And that's why she like does the whole green card marriage thing, but thankfully it falls through.
I think Debbie's main error here is assuming that white people operate under the same social code as Asian people, which is like, she's not going to tell anyone that she gave up her ring. She needs to save face, which is not how they operate. They will tell everybody. And that's how Jessica found out, because Savannah told her friend Gigi, who's her marketing person, and Gigi confronts Jessica. Right.
Yeah. Oh, man. Gigi and Jessica's friendship. Oh, that was rough.
Yeah. I don't think that's surviving. I mean, I know she offered an olive leaf at the end, but I don't know. Those types of risks.
I mean, like you really can't recover from like saying racist comments to your to your like non-white friend. Like I mean, there was like a moment of growth, her being like, hey, that was like uncool of me to say that, like, you know, your parents' shop was like unhygienic and like, you know, kind of, you know, painting a stereotype over them. That was like wrong of me. But at the same time, I'm like, you grew up with Jessica. You know this family. You know how hard they worked. And you probably have been to the salon like many times during like grade school. And it's also like I found it really relatable when Jessica went to Gigi's like dinner party or soiree at her apartment, where everybody is like, you know, they are talking about how much money they make, like what milestones they've reached. Everybody's like super ambitious, and that is like the friendship circle that Gigi has cultivated. And now that Jessica doesn't have her Hollywood job anymore, it's kind of like, okay, well, why are we friends? Like, you're not making me look as cool. And it's kind of like the same thing as Debbie and Jessica's relationship, or like, you're supposed to make me look cool and good. And it's like, okay, those friendships, they don't last, because you're not seeing your friend as like a human being with vulnerabilities. You're just trying to like clout farm or a farm, and it's not okay.
Yeah. And also, like, when you say those things to your friend, it kind of shows them that you've had these thoughts all along.
You've had these thoughts. Yeah. They don't just come out of nowhere.
And it's like, you know, Jessica's the type of person who will give everyone a benefit of the doubt, right? She like, they couldn't have possibly meant it this way. But when you make it crystal clear what you think about her family and her business, their business, it's like, oh, there's really no coming back from that. Like, you can accept, I mean, if I was Jessica, I would accept the olive branch. But going forward, this is a transactional relationship. It's no longer a relationship based on like history and friendship, right? Because you've shown that like, you're not really a friend.
Yeah, I mean, forgiveness does not mean you forget.
Yeah.
And, you know, once trust is broken, you can't really rebuild the same trust.
Yeah.
So, honestly, that friendship is dead in the water, in my opinion. Yeah, they've definitely demoted Gigi to, like, acquaintance at best at this point.
Yeah. Or like just business partner, right? Because she does help Jessica find a location for a new salon. But it's like, yeah, like I said, this is transactional now. Like, we will use each other for connections, but I don't know if, like, it'll probably take years and years and years for the trust to come back.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was funny because, like, Jessica's from Hollywood, right? Like, from, like, her job. She's been living in L.A. for all these years. And I'm like, that's a lot of, like, what West L.A. is like. You are constantly making connections because you want to, like, social climb. You want to, like, get those opportunities. And that is, like, one of the best ways to get jobs. And it's like, yeah, that mentality, like, Jessica never had that mentality. She was never going to survive in Hollywood. So I just thought it was funny how, like, Gigi, who is not from LA, and, like, she seems to have that mentality. And I was like, oh, she would have done really well in LA as, like, a publicist.
Yeah. I still, like, did she ever tell, she never told her parents why she broke up with her fiance, right?
No.
Yeah. Because this whole family is too
proud. I think Debbie already knows, though. Yeah. And I thought it was really funny that, you know, Dustin brings his girlfriend over, like, a few times. And the family's like, oh, she's, you know, she's very pretty and, like, very driven. And it turns out that her family's rich. So, yeah, like, it sounds like you guys are a good match. And Jessica's like, what the fuck? Like, every single boyfriend that I've brought, you've, like, had to criticize, including, like, my ex-fiancé. We were like, oh, he's too boring. And it's like, what does that mean? Like, why is that, like, a character flaw for you? Why is that a deal breaker? But, I mean, the parents were right. He turned out to be a scumbag in the end. But
I mean, it could be one of two things or even both, right? One is that Jessica's just a terrible choice in men. And two, it's because Dustin's a boy. It's probably, and, you know, both of those things are probably true. I mean, I was hoping Phil would have gotten more comeuppance, more backlash. It seems like he got off pretty light, given that he's the source of all these subsequent bad decisions. And that he never really, like, repents, right? He never, like, acknowledges or apologizes. Like, he kind of just lives life expecting other people to pick up the pieces, pick up his messes, clean up his messes, right? Like, during, was it the birthday or the baby shower for Debbie's former friend, Nemesis, yeah. where he was, like, just talking shit about the other salons that were mentioned in the New York Times article and how, like, oh, they're not doing it right. Like, they're not doing like us. We're doing the right way. It's like, dude, you did everything the wrong way. You do not have the platform.
Higher ground.
Yeah. To talk about it this way. And, you know, that speech is what drives Tui to, like, make her decision and, like, quote unquote, betray the family, but really just, like, looking out for herself. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, I think it shows Phil's growth in a way at the end because, you know, Phil is like, oh, yeah, I was being really hypocritical. And, you know, like, my niece, like, she decided to do what's best for her, like, for her survival and for her family. Like, this wasn't just, like, a very, like, selfish choice where she's like, I'm going to stick it to the family that got me a green card and, you know, allowed me to live in their house rent free. Like, it wasn't, like, malicious. Like, there was a lot of thought behind it. And he's just like, you know what? Good for you. I understand. And that makes me think that he has grown to a point where he realizes that, like, he needs to reflect on his own, like, selfish choices and how he should consider his family more rather than just, like, thinking of Sunshine Nails as, like, his family, where it's like, it's just a business. Like, it's not end all be all. I know it seems that way because you worked in the salon for like 20 years, but writing was on the wall, man.
Yeah, I want to believe you, but also I don't know if I read that from his like.
Well, I said there was growth, but do I think he's gonna probably mess up again and, you know, have a backslide? Yeah, 100%. He's a gambler. Even if he beat that addiction, it's still like in his. I don't know, like he makes so many mistakes and he just expects forgiveness. And if there's no consequences, like serious consequences, then yeah, he's going to keep thinking that he can be forgiven for everything.
Yeah, like when Debbie found out about his loan from the loan shark at the same baby shower, the reason that she goes ahead and like does what she does, which is blackmailing Savannah, was because Phil ran away for the night. And was not there to talk to her and talk through their problems, their issues, right? And so she took it upon herself to, like, you know, use this. Because she had already stalked Savannah at this point and gotten the picture, right? And that was already, like, you know, a questionable decision. But also, like, you know, aunties will be nosy. That's how they are. But, like, she chose to run away from his problem and, like, get even more drunk. And essentially left Debbie to, like, figure things out. And then
I was really pissed at Eam, who, like, the loan shark, who was just like, oh, your husband's not picking up, so it's up to you to, like, pay me back. And I'm like, what?
I mean, that's what loan sharks do. That's how they get their money. But then also, like, Debbie being so proud and being so, like, protective of Phil pays back the loan with the ring and tells him not to tell Phil where the money came from. And so Phil assumes that, like, oh, he figured it out, or like everything worked out, it's fine, right? And it's like, at some point, like, you wonder if in the back of his mind he can, like, figure it out, like, he's thinking that, like, this doesn't make sense, like, problems will just go away like that, someone must have done something. But, you know, from what we read, he just, like, oh, things worked out, this is great, no more problems. It's like, dude, I wanted him to have more of, like, even just like a catharsis moment of like, oh, I am the problem.
Yeah, I mean, that lasted maybe a couple of scenes where like, oh, I am the problem. I will, you know, reflect on this. I just don't know how much longer that act is going to last. But with the whole like Debbie saying, oh, I don't want my husband to know that I like fixed his problem for him. It kind of reminds me of when, you know, people, there's always someone who says, oh, we'll figure it out. And I'm like, those people who say that, they never figure it out. It's usually like their spouse or someone around them who is like fixing everything and figuring it out for them.
Yeah. There's this, you know, if you're on couples or married people TikTok or social media, there's a lot of discussion on like mental load, right? And how like the wife is usually the one managing the household and thinking of a lot of the things that go into like bills and packing for things and like making sure the fridge is stocked and making sure the house is running, that like the husband just offloads that.
Yeah, because like they're only considering their time, right? Like, so an example would be, okay, they're about to leave the house for a trip or whatever, and the guy's like, okay, I just have to get dressed and then pack my stuff and then put it in the trunk, go to the bathroom one last time, and I'm ready to go. Meanwhile, their wives are, you know, getting the kids dressed, making sure that, you know, they have all of the diapers and like supplies and snacks, and then they have to get ready themselves. But by that point, the husband is just like, why are you taking so long? I don't understand. And it's like, yeah, because you only got ready for yourself. You didn't even think about other people. And
yeah,
that's kind of what Phil is. He's someone who like does not think outside of his own needs and problems, and therefore his problems become everybody else's problems.
Yeah.
It's very frustrating, but I think every woman can probably relate, whether they have like a relationship or not. You've probably dealt with something like that.
That's true. If you've read this book and you don't think Phil is the problem, you should examine, you should like reflect on that yourself and like why don't you think he's the problem?
Honestly, like I read a lot of Reddit posts and the number of times when it's the husband's fault, the man's fault, and I'm like, the solution is to just leave them. Like, you guys have money problems? It's because of that person? Okay, then just leave that person. Like, you do not have to stay with them. Like, what is this, like, sense of loyalty? Like, people think that sacrifice is a way to show, like, how much love you have for someone, but I think there is really, like, there are some lines that you shouldn't cross, and I feel like Phil crosses all of them, you know?
Yeah.
At this point, it's just better for Debbie to divorce him and, you know, live her own life. It sounded like she needed some rest because she sounded like really tired throughout the book, you know?
Yeah. What did you think about her very, like, at the end of the book, is her very last act of pettiness?
I'm all for it. I mean, I love how she's just like, you can find anyone's address. And if you try hard enough, and I'm just like, yeah, that is true. All, like, women are FBI agents. Like, we can find out anything based, like, through the internet.
I mean, what's Savannah going to do? Track her down at her now shuttered salon that she helped close because of her justification? Like, just merely don't cheat on your fiance. That was the solution to your problem.
I also, like, the fact that she made a physical copy of the photo because of her hoarder mentality of just, like, you can't lose things. You have to have, like, what if you need something? You can't just throw that away. And that's what pretty much, you know,
yeah,
quote unquote, saved her at the end of the day. It's like, yeah, like, she had that because, you know, she thought ahead.
That reminds me of, like, it was one of my favorite scenes, which was when they ran into Savannah, when the family runs into Savannah and her, you know, her, I guess, side piece at the shitty Asian buffet in Toronto.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if your family is a buffet family, but my family definitely loved going to.
I feel like every Asian family is a buffet family. Like, I swear to God, like, even when the food is not good, it's all about the bargain, right?
Yeah.
And there's, like, a rule when you go to buffets, like, you go for the most expensive stuff, right, to make it worthwhile. Get the meat, get the seafood.
As long as there is a crab leg shellfish station, it'll be worth it. And that scene was just so, like, I was laughing because, like, every single family member had their own procedure on how to maximize the buffet. And I was like, yo, yeah, I recognize every single one of these plates that they're, yeah, making.
Yeah. Like, I've seen, like, so many, like, skits on social media about, like, Asian people, like, maximizing their buffet experience. And then, like, the non-Asian person that they bring with them to the buffet is just like, I'm full. Like, yeah, I don't think I can eat another bite. And it's like, no, this is not a pleasure trip. This is business. You need to fill up as much as possible. Yeah. It's a competition
we
at that point.
We can't let the buffet win, right?
We can't let the man win.
We can't leave money on the table here. We paid $30 to get in here. We have to eat at least $30 worth of crab legs.
Yes, yes. I remember, okay, so, I mean, this is a side, but this is where I, like, at those buffets, this is where I found out that I was allergic to chicken.
Oh, no.
And, it, like, at first, our family was like, maybe it's because, I don't know, maybe it's something to do with the hygiene at that restaurant, because you've never had this reaction before. Because I had, like, hives all over me. And they're like, we're never going to go to that buffet again. And then the moment we realized, oh, no, it's just me being allergic to chicken. And it was not the restaurant's fault. My family is like, okay, then we can go back.
We just don't eat the chicken. It's problem solved.
Yeah, just don't eat the chicken. Like, you know, like, it was a really good deal. Like, we can go back now.
I mean, that's just how much Asian families love buffets.
Yeah, yeah. So...
yeah.
Yeah.
The most relatable eventually part of I that grew book out.
I mean, eventually I grew out of my chicken allergy, as in I kept eating it until I, like, somehow built immunity to it. I don't recommend people doing that. But I mean,
that's how people do like allergy treatment, which is like just exposure. As long as it's not like a deadly anaphylactic reaction, yeah. You can probably get through it. You'll just be really uncomfortable for like the process, but.
Yeah, that's what I did. I like didn't eat as much chicken. It's just like you gradually add more and more. I'm just saying, do you know how good Korean fried chicken is? You think I was going to give that up? Absolutely not.
But yeah, definitely. I think Maya wrote a very, very good buffet scene. And it was definitely a highlight of a book full of highlights. I really had a lot of fun reading this book. I liked the messages. I liked that, you know, all the characters were flawed and messy. But I also enjoyed that this was about a messy family that wasn't rich. We read quite a few like kind of like rich, messy family stories. And it's kind of cool to like see the story from like a more working class perspective as well.
Yeah. And I'm glad that it was also like not like super serious on like the war trauma. Like it's mentioned, but it's like background. Like, you know why characters do things. It's not like the centerpiece. And it was like really funny. And also this book was, you know, like our summer patron pick, right? But we were all joking, saying like, well, all the last summer patron picks have like not taken place during the summer, despite like the titles and the covers. So we're like, let's see how long the summer lasts in this book, or if it even, you know, matches the theme of summer.
And I think we succeeded. I think this was a true summer read.
Although it did like span a couple of almost a year in terms of the time passage in the book.
That's true.
Because it's like summer and then they go through Christmas and then it's past like.
That's true.
February. So it goes almost like a full year.
But summer was mentioned. Which is an improvement, because the last patron choice summer read actually took place in fall through winter. So there was no summer at all. So yeah. So yeah.
It also took place in Seattle, where like it is also cold.
Yeah.
So yeah. Lots of mentions of like Toronto winter in the book as well. So maybe not too much summer, but there was a little bit.
Yeah, I had a really good time reading this book. I enjoy family, like Asian Canadian family stories like this, especially ones that kind of built in the multi-generational point of view. I think, you know, it's just a really fun way to experience like the Asian diaspora experience through the eyes of like a whole family.
Yeah, and I mean, in the author's note at the very end, Mai writes, "There would be no Sunshine Nails without my parents." And she said in a couple of interviews that, you know, her parents did run a nail salon in Halifax in Canada. And she was talking about. Yeah. And she was saying like, oh, like I like since I was 8, like they've been running that business. I did like my homework there. I brought friends there. So like she said in an interview with CBC, "Seeing my parents thrive just from operating a nail salon inspired me to write a book showing the behind the scenes of what goes on there." And I really appreciate the fact that it wasn't like, again, too serious. Like when Phil says we're not one of those salons, I'm like, I'm glad that it wasn't about that, you know. It wasn't a story about like undocumented manicurists who are forced to sleep on the floor of the salon because, you know, they're held hostage. Like, I'm glad it wasn't that type of salon and we didn't get that type of story.
It would be a whole totally different book if that were the case.
Yeah.
I guess with that, that'll do it for our discussion of Sunshine Nails by Mai Nguyen. As always, if you have any comments on either the book itself or our discussion of it, please let us know either on Discord or our Goodreads forums. We always love to hear your feedback on our discussion episodes whenever possible. And yeah, I guess it's time to announce our book club pick for the month of August 2026, which is my pick. And for this month, we will be reading Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro. This is the second Kazuo Ishiguro book we're reading for this book club after Never Let Me Go. Since Never Let Me Go, which you read almost like 8-9 years ago, it's been a while since we
it was back when we were still recording in a studio.
Yeah, and I remember that book being very if you know Kazuo Ishiguro, you know you're in for some just like melancholic speculative fiction. And Clara and the Sun is a story about Clara, who was an artificial friend, and her experience dealing with I guess humans. And the reason that we wanted to read this book is because the film adaptation, if you listen to our book news episode, you know this already, but the film adaptation of Clara and the Sun, directed by Taika Waititi and starring Jenna Ortega, is coming out later this year. So I have resolved to be better at reading the book before watching the film. And so this book club will help me fulfill that resolution. But yeah, really excited. I know this is something that you also wanted to read, Rira, so I'm sorry for taking your pick.
No, it's okay. I was going to read it regardless, whether it was for this podcast or just for like my leisure time. So
So I'm really excited. I know it's still August, still summer, but you know, I'm hoping this book will give us the same kind of sad but hopeful vibes of Never Let Me Go. But I'm ready for whatever this book throws at me. So yeah, as always, we'll be just releasing our reading schedule on Discord as well as Patreon. So remember to check that out. And looking forward to discussing this book with all of you online as well. But with that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba and our discussion of Sunshine Nails by Mai Nguyen. Thank you once again to our patrons for helping us choose this month's book club pick. And we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @BooksandBoba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, sports fans. Welcome to Asians in Hockey. You may not realize it, but there's a rich history of Asians and AAPI folks who have contributed to the legacy of the greatest game on ice. From classic legends like Julie Chu and Robin Bawa, to current greats like Lia Lum and Nick Suzuki, and even rising stars like Akane Shiga and Jason Robertson. We'll cover their stories, celebrate their accomplishments, and learn about their impact on the sport of hockey. I'm Nate Nakao, former beer league player, occasional youth hockey coach, and longtime hockey fan, and I'll be your host as we take a look at the rise of Asians in hockey. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Host the podcast Asians in Baseball alongside Naomi Koh and Scott Okamoto. Asians in Baseball is exactly what it sounds like, a podcast about the Asian and Asian Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Americans in Major League Baseball. Every week, we break down the highlights of what's going on with Asians in baseball and then take a deeper dive into the Asian and Asian Americans past and present who have shaped baseball as it is today. Whether you're Kim Eng's number one fan or you've never even heard of Hideo Nomo, we've got something for everyone, especially for the Shohei Ohtani stans. Maybe too much for the Shohei Ohtani stans. Listen to Asians in Baseball wherever you get podcasts, part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.